Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Tuesday, for Open Mics. Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, as you probably know, even though one is in the works now, is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, great to be here.
Thank you for coming in, Nancy. So income inequality is a big buzzword. You know, Pope Francis is talking about it, and Barack Obama is talking about it, and lots of us, we've talked about it many times. But now there's this new book by this new economist that's getting a load of buzz about the same subject. So fill us in, please.
So Thomas Piketty is a French economist. I make him to be in his early 40s, if I've done the backward math on it. He, very well trained, spent some time at MIT and, you know, has talked about that a little bit, what he learned by being in the new world, so to speak, or being in America. Found his experience here to be a little, in academics, to be a little too devoid, I think, or a little too distant from real-world problems. And has spent what sounds like, I mean, I haven't read a lot about this, but what sounds like, you know, a decade assembling with Emmanuel Saez, who many of our listeners will know as a well-published and very knowledgeable, very credible economist of income and wealth inequality, who has an appointment at Berkeley, has spent a lot of time with Saez developing what sounds like a really, really important set of data around not just inequality in the United States, not just inequality in Europe, but inequality all over the world. And the data is data that's not just for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, but goes way back. So he has come with the data assembled with Saez to a series of, I think, very powerful, thought-provoking, and what will stand as flagstone-like arguments or contentions about inequality's natural tendencies in capitalism. The name of the book, Thomas Piketty, P-I-C-K-E-T-T-Y, Harvard University Press. They moved the press date up, something academic presses rarely do because it's gotten so much traction with reviewers and economists and commentators on business and capitalism. They moved the release date up till March. It's just come out, 696 pages, count them. He has come to a series of very interesting conclusions. The title of the book is Capital in the 21st Century, and John Cassidy, who's reviewed it in a very interesting piece in The New Yorker, the most recent edition, you know, and others have commented on the kind of parallels between calling a book Capital and Marx's Das Kapital. And they both are, Marx's book is, but Piketty's work is going to be a kind of, you know, touchstone for how we think about the operations of global capitalism.
Why?
For many, many years to come. Because like Wealth of Nations, I put it in that camp very carefully, or Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, or Ricardo's Principles of Political Economy, published about 44 years after Smith's book in 1776. Like both those books, he's laying down a set of arguments about how capitalism works as a kind of organic, you know, machine, organic set of relationships. And he's doing something very interestingly distinct from Ricardo or Smith, but more akin to Marx, saying you can't really divorce capitalism and what we get from political actions, from the relationship between politics and economy. You need to think about the workings of capitalism in the context of the old-fashioned word political economy. Very, very interesting. Very, you know, a lot of us would recognize that, the truth of that. But here's the real point. So the point of the book is capitalism has a bunch of different principles that we need to think about the way it works and consider this as its natural default drive. One of which is, and this moves strongly in contrast to the way many of us, politicians, policymakers, economists today, have for at least 50 or 60 years thought about, maybe 70, thought about capitalism. And that is that left to its own devices, you know, incomes will tend over a certain stage of development to come together, to converge. He's saying exactly the opposite, that there are driving forces, not just today, but over the long run, that actually move incomes in opposite directions, that diverge, that create a rigid class of people. Think about, you know, the French Revolution, or think about old world society, a rigid class system in which a small group of people control the majority of the wealth and the income, and that contrary to the way most
America in 2014.
Bingo. right? Okay. And he has a, you know, his numbers that make your jaws drop, but we all we can recognize the truth of this. Let me just give you sprinkle this, you know, long-winded explanation with a few of them, little breadcrumbs. In 2012, the top 1% of the income distribution collected 22.5% of the income. If you widen that to the top 10%, it's more than 45% of the income. Or, to get even more shocking but true, all 95% of the income growth since the beginning of the Great Recession through 2012, 95% has gone to the top 1%. So all that money, all that gold off the table went to the top 1%. So he's arguing that actually the 50 years or 40 years of income equality of convergence between, say, roughly 1945 and 1975 was an aberration. An aberration. So
because of depressions, wars, and
rebuilding,
sort of things,
right?
And also, we had much, much higher tax rates.
And there, here we go. He's arguing, you leave this animal, this organism, this ecosystem alone, and you're going to create Marie Antoinette and everybody else all over again, right? In modern day America, Europe, developing countries, China. His data show remarkable trends toward this effect after a certain stage of development in lots and lots of places. So, absent government policy, absent progressive, intentional action, this is what we may end up with. And he says, isn't it ironic? In the land of America, right, we're going to end up with Balzac's Pere Goriot, Jane Austen's tiny little group of, you know, wealthy aristocrats in Mansfield Park, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, one of the things I've always found fascinating reading about the, you know, period of enormous growth in the United States, what is our tax rate now, like 33 or something like that?
Mid-30s, mid-30s. Yeah, top rate.
And at the time of JFK, the rates on the most wealthy were up like close to 90%. Yep. I mean, it was like crazy. And they were very high during World War II as well. But yep. I can't – so was that a big deal?
He thinks that's a big deal. And in fact –
allowing the middle class to grow.
Well, yeah. And in redistributing income, which he says, left to its own devices, will default into divergence, right? So yes. And then one of the most controversial parts of the book is his call for a kind of global tax, right? A kind of global wealth tax. And he's got different kind of, you can double click on that in a sense in the book and learn and see alternatives to that. That is what, if you look at the firestorm of conversation around this, that not interesting enough, not his conclusions, not the raison d'etre of this book, not the highway along which the arguments and the data and the significance of what he's writing about travel. That's not getting tons and tons of controversy. What's getting controversy is his political, you know, his suggested political or policy solutions to this.
Because it's a non-solution, though. I mean,
but it's a non-starter, right?
Exactly. I mean,
we can't agree on carbon emissions.
Exactly.
Right?
And his view as to why it's got to be a global progressive right. wealth tax is because, as most people who aren't economists know, that one of the ways the wealthy avoid progressive taxation mm-hmm. is they transfer their assets yep. to places that, if you want to go state to state, Florida, yep. you go to New Hampshire, has no income tax. You go to Florida, which has no estate tax.
Right.
Or you go to another country.
Or you go to another country.
The whole notion is a global wealth tax would capture all this. But even he acknowledges it's beyond unlikely. And so what I say as a non-economist is, and when I was reading all this stuff about him, while it seems that he has great insight, and I obviously virtually everybody in your line of work thinks he has colossal insight,
Said something very, very important based on good data.
But if you don't have a solution that's plausible to this collection of good data, what have you added to the, not you, what has he added to the conversation?
So, so it's interesting that you say that, Jim, because I actually come at it from exactly the opposite standpoint. I think, boy, this guy has done his homework, and what an important moment for, you know, the kind of rarefied air of economic academics to jump into, you know, into our world conversation. So, here's what he's done. Here's the contribution. If you were at Harvard Business School, this is why you would give him a 1 for his class participation, because he has really, really strong evidence that this is happening, and it will worsen. Now, you can quibble and argue and stack, kind of poke that pig, if you will. But let me tell you, I don't think you're going to break the skin in a huge way. That in itself, it's a little bit like where we've arrived with climate change. It's getting harder and harder, right? Just look at the weather patterns to say climate change and global warming are some kind of, you know, fantasy made up by liberal tree huggers. So I think what he's done is contribute an enormous amount of credibility to the idea that we have a worsening, serious global issue. Very few people have assembled the kind of data and written with the kind of boldness, supported boldness, that Thomas Piketty has.
So your position is, as long as we have a decent set of facts that people of different political views can agree upon, in theory,
we get a lot closer to policy, conversation, and solution.
Because the economists that would be drawn into this administration or around the world,
or Republican administrations, right?
Great
or the
Britain
World
or
Bank
France.
Or the IMF.
Okay.
Exactly.
What might be coming from
exactly.
the same.
Exactly. So,
what I don't understand about this, so I apparently wrongly assumed that this income inequality thing was much worse. We always talk about how, you know, there was this great piece in the New York Times over the weekend talking about how back in the Gilded Age, John Pierpont Morgan was endorsing a 20-to-1 ratio between what the CEO made and what the worker made. And now we're up to 354 times the CEOs make 354 times what the worker made. So I wrongly thought this was fairly new. But what you're saying is it's not. It's just other government interventions kept it to be less dramatic.
Well, a combination of forces, right? I think equalized wealth. And he's arguing this. I can't take any credit, right?
Okay.
A combination of forces, right? Everything from the demolition of Europe and the rebuilding there to, you know, a lot of wealth destroyed, right? A lot of wealthy people's wealth destroyed. Just think about art collections during the Second World War. A lot of different forces. Government action was one of those, and particularly in America. But I think that we don't have any real numbers on CEO to average worker pay. You know, we don't have them very far back at all. They only go back really reliably to the 1950s. But those numbers astoundingly diverge in that time, right? So 20-to-1 is the average large company's CEO pay to the average worker in the mid-1950s.
Yeah.
Right? By the 1980s, it's 200-to-1. By today, right, it's over 300-to-1.
Right.
There's one astounding statistic in the John Cassie Review. In 2011, Tim Cook took home $378 million in cash and stock-based compensation as the CEO of Apple. That was 6,258 times what the typical Apple worker made. So one of the very – stay with me on this. This is really important. It's Piketty's. It belongs completely to him, but it's really important. It's another way he's going to change the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
He argues that a huge amount of the wealth in America that has gone to the top 1% is not being generated by – you know, Oprah Winfrey making $77 million last year, which she did. Highest paid celebrity in America. I learned that because I just taught Oprah Winfrey in my leadership class. It's not being generated by that. It's actually being generated by CEO compensation. And then he made a huge percentage of it. 70% of that diversion of income going to the top 1%, he argues, is the C-suite. And that means it's boards of directors, it's compensation consultants, right? It's shareholders who don't have legal means to really challenge that and stop that railroad, that rail engine on the tracks. But then he says, isn't it ironic that we're doing that and we're somehow attributing superstar status to managers and corporate officers who by definition do things in a group? So it's very hard to attribute huge amounts of performance, even if performance-based compensation actually had legal and practical teeth, which we know it doesn't. There are lots of CEOs from lousily performing companies who are taking home a big pot of gold at the end of the week. He said, isn't it interesting that ironically we're giving these individuals who work in a group and who by definition do things in a group, we're singling them out and actually feeding the monster of massively diverging income inequality.
Let me throw a few things in.
So
this
that's
mix,
a
by the way.
Really important piece
by
the
way,
of this compensation, the compensation, you know, if you will, conversation we need to be looking at.
Now, even if Nancy Kane is right, and she knows a little bit more about this than I do, I would acknowledge.
She
even
does,
if she's
Jimmy,
right,
are
yeah,
you
it's
sure?
shocking. Even if it turns out she's right that operating, at least for most people, from the same set of data is a good start. We are so far away from dealing with any. By the way, Piketty, while he wants his global wealth tax that he admits is unlikely, thinks the solutions, and I use that term in quote, that are being advanced by governments like ours are going to accomplish virtually nothing. And let's talk about the current state of affairs. We have a proposal by the president that is going nowhere to raise the minimum wage to $10.10. And while people are fighting for that, the National Low-Income Housing Coalition says to rent a modest apartment in this country and just break even and have all those expenses, you need $18.92 an hour to break even and have no money left over. Democrats and a few Republicans are fighting for almost roughly half that, and they're not going to achieve it. Number two, what I had forgotten about or never knew until Marjorie mentioned this piece that about the income gap that you two were talking about between the CEOs and their line workers, is when you said before, we really don't know the most current data, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, about the ratio. One of the reasons
from the past, we don't
even know it from the current, because in this is what I didn't know. In the Dodd-Frank bill, there was a provision that would have forced American companies to disclose the ratio of the compensation of their CEO to the median compensation of their employees, which would give us the same kind of data that you're praising with Piketty, because
in,
at least we know the facts. Exactly.
SEC documents.
And what is Congress's response to the bill that they passed into law? To delay for 4 years the disclosure. Now, what does that mean? It means we're never going to see the information. When it comes close to 4 years, they'll delay it another five years. So even if we agree, Nancy Kane, that the data from Piketty is being celebrated from coast to coast and beyond, what's the breakthrough moment? Who is the breakthrough person? What's the breakthrough idea that's going to rally left, right, and middle to begin to solve this problem? Because a lot of people, do they buy the notion that it even is a problem?
I don't think they do. We would have this conversation many times on our previous radio station about a guy like Tim Cook with 370.
Well, he's making a billion after that, right?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know what he's making now.
I don't know what he made last year, but I gave you the figure.
Okay, $378 million. And something in me says that's really kind of gross, that this isn't something that we should laud or think is wonderful. I mean, what do you do after the first $50 million? You know, I think he can squeak by. But you get calls from people who say, this is a capitalist country. You
free
can make as much
yeah.
as you want. This is free enterprise, blah, 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 blah. It's so bizarre.
I've been at the Harvard Business School 21 years. It's an astounding place, and it's not that we don't have our issues, but it's an astounding crucible to kind of grow up as a historian. And again, I've said this before on the air. I think historians generally get better as we age, like wine, right? And spaghetti. The second
spaghetti.
Day. Right? Spaghetti sauce much better the second day.
The sauce,
or
okay.
The fourth day, right? So, one of the things I think about when I think about a question like that, or your question, Jim, so I want to take Marjorie's first and come back to yours, is, look, we want to reward people to incentivize and to recognize, to incentivize them to do their best work, and that includes paying people that have responsibility for large organizations, a healthy salary or healthy compensation, and we want to recognize what they've done. So, no one is talking, at least in my worlds and the worlds that I read about some kind of cooperative arrangement for compensating, executives, but it's about the magnitude. It's about the levels. We're not talking, should we pay, a CEO $10 million or should we pay them $3 million? We're talking about $378 million or $500 million or $80 million in the case of some CEOs where the company's stock price and market performance was much below expectation and shareholders and employees suffered. So we're talking about orders of magnitude. We're also talking about signaling. Right? What is the signal this sends to Americans and the rest of the world about what our economy and our corporate sector is really about? And then we're talking about something even more important than both of those, which is think about the categorical imperative of Kant, right? Act only on things that you are prepared to see generalized, right? That was his idea about a kind of, bedrock for morality. It's really interesting when you start thinking about it. Do we really want, I don't care how much wealth we have or don't have or aspire to have, do we, any of us, as Americans or as members of a global village, really want to live in a let-them-eat-cake society in which a very, very small number of people take a lot of the gold, most of the gold, 95% of the income growth of the gold. And I don't care whether you are the wealthiest person in this country. If you really are prepared to act on what that looks like in 20 years, your answer is no. It is no, because that is a society with of increased suffering, of increased social instability.
Well, that's one of the reasons the Occupy movement, as short-lived as it was had
really
such resonance
it's
with
just
so
the
many
beginning.
People.
So here's the answer.
I hope it's just the beginning.
That's the lead into the answer to your question, Jim. So what's the breakthrough moment? I mean, why don't you ask, you know, Fred Shuttlesworth, who led the on-the-street organizations in Birmingham in 1963 against Bull Connor. They didn't know that was going to be the breakthrough moment. It was a breakthrough moment, right? Or some of those students in Greensboro who sat down. They've been sitting down for a lot of years. Or ask Lincoln, was the Emancipation Proclamation going to change everything? He didn't know that. It was, but he didn't know that. Or Robert Moses, who was a civil rights worker who went on to lead the Algebra Project out of Cambridge and has really changed the face of a lot of high school education, particularly for black minority students in America. The breakthrough moment is never something we can pinpoint. But until we really start lighting the kindling, we're never going to set it afire and get a breakthrough blaze. So we're beginning to do that here, and we need to do that because the answer to the question, do you really want to live and let them eat cake society, for almost everybody is no.
Nancy, you spend a lot of time in leadership courses and interviews you do with some pretty high-profile executives in this country. If you were talking to them and there was no tape recorder and you said this was off the record and you were to say to them, do you think the fact that Tim Cook makes, 6,000 times what the median worker at Apple makes, or the average American CEO makes 354 times at least what the average median worker in his or her corporation makes, would they say yes to you?
I think most smart thinking, broad-looking executives would say yes, this has gotten out of hand.
Right, they wouldn't say this is what we need to compete in the global work marketplace.
I don't think so.
In
a very candid, no, because why? Because what got these people in most cases, not all cases, but what got them to the place they have is the ability to see not just right now, but beyond, and what it means not just for them, right, but for their customers, or their continued market ability to market to lots of customers, or their continued ability to hire well-trained workers. All those things, are vulnerable when we get closer and closer to let them eat cake.
You know who should lead the movement, Nancy? Yeah, we're
she
looking
lead
at
the
her.
Movement.
Exactly.
That's
I'd
right.
Follow.
I think Nancy
I'm
Kane
serious,
is our breakthrough
Nancy.
Moment right over there. Okay. Nancy, you are fantastic. That was wonderful. Nancy's an historian at Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. I always love to talk to you, Nancy. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We've got the Boston Globe editor, Brian McGroy, with us, and medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in.